Okay, we have the pleasure today to hear from Alina. I used to call her Alina, but it's Alina. And this is going to be something that's related to her dissertation, so any feedback that you want to offer will be very helpful. And do you want to have questions during it, or help?
I'm happy to have them at the end, but if it's something that's really pressing, I'm also happy to answer questions during the presentation.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for attending my presentation today. I know that this is the last in the series before Halloween, and I hope I got the spot because of the content and not because I'm originally from Transylvania. So for the people who don't know me, my name is Alina Plumar. I'm not a vampire. I'm a third-year PhD student at the Fielding School of Public Health in the Department of Health Policy and Management. And this past summer, I was fortunate enough to receive a summer graduate research grant. And I hope that by conducting this research, I put it to good use. I would like to use this opportunity to thank Dr. Hayes, who very kindly and generously provided feedback for me throughout the research process. All right, so let's crack on with this. The title of my presentation is Conceptual and Empirical Overlap of Subjective Well-being and health-related quality of life. As you look at this title, you might ask yourselves, why subjective well-being, why health-related quality of life, why does this even matter? Well, I hope that we can agree that the objective of medicine and of public health in general is to improve the quality of life of individuals, but also of whole populations. I would also like to note that in medicine, quantitative clinical measurements are absolutely vital indicators of an individual's physical function. Examples of such measurements include blood pressure, body mass index, heart rate, blood sugar, etc. Quantitative data on a mass scale, on the other hand, can highlight problematic trends such as increase in obesity and increase in morbidity that may require government intervention. However, we should point out that quantitative measurements tell only part of an increasingly holistic picture of a patient's well-being. If we are to recognize that good quality of life is what individuals and nations aspire to, then we recognize that we need a way of measuring, we need a way of reporting, and we need a way of comparing these measurements. In healthcare, we use health-related quality of life measurements, and they are used both at local level, for example, in hospitals, and at national level, for example, the CDC, and these are used to guide decision makers. But in public policy and economics, subjective well-being is also used as a measure of how individuals perceive their own quality of life. So in this presentation, I will compare health-related quality of life and subjective well-being in order to examine if subjective well-being measurements add anything new and meaningful in terms of our understanding of patient well-being. My presentation breaks down into five parts, and I certainly hope there will be some highlights, so here are my predictions. In part one, I will define subjective well-being and health-related quality of life. I will use definitions that I feel communicate what these concepts really are about, and I hope that they will serve as a point of reference for you throughout the lecture. In part two, I will introduce the research question and the methods, and then in parts three and four, I will review the findings from the conceptual approach and from the empirical approach. And finally, in part five, I will discuss directions for future research, particularly in the context of the findings of the study and also with a view to applications in clinical practice. So let's start at the beginning. What is subjective well-being? Well, simply put, subjective well-being is a measurement of how individuals perceive and experience their quality of life. And even though this definition appears to be simple, when one reviews the literature on subjective well-being, one gets a sense of the remarkable diversity in how scholars have understood, defined, conceptualized, and operationalized well-being. For my definition, I will reference two studies because they build on one another. The first one is one published by Ryan and Betty in 2001. They proposed a definition of well-being that is predicated on two fundamentally different views of human nature: hedonic well-being and eudaimonic well-being. Let's have a look at hedonic well-being first. Hedonism as a philosophy of life originates in ancient Greece. Under this view, the goal of life is to maximize the amount of pleasure that people experience, the amount of pleasure and happiness. And some scholars argue that it refers only to pleasures of the body, but others say that it includes pleasures of the mind as well. If we look at eudaimonic well-being, this is slightly different, and it goes beyond happiness, because eudaimonia, roughly translated, means fulfillment of the self. So eudaimonic well-being rests on the actualization of the human potential, on fulfilling and realizing the true nature of a person. And it is distinct from happiness because not all desires yield well-being when achieved, and not all desires may promote well-being. If you take PhD students, for example, they're very motivated to succeed in academia, and they work so hard, sometimes it may be detrimental to their well-being. A decade later, Dolan and colleagues published a model that builds on Ryan and Betty's, and they argue that subjective well-being is measured in three different ways. Evaluative well-being, which is a sort of global perspective on how one perceives their lives. And when we apply eudaimonic well-being measures, we elicit a respondent's global subjective evaluation of his or her life. However, we should note that this evaluation can also apply to distinct domains of life, such as satisfaction with work, satisfaction with family life, and even satisfaction with health. Then we have eudaimonic well-being, which measures the underlying psychological needs of an individual, such as autonomy, personal growth, and purpose in life. And finally, experienced well-being, which measures how respondents are feeling at a specific point in time. And some scholars argue that this type of well-being more directly relates to somebody's environment and context in life. So now we know what subjective well-being is, right? It's a measurement of how somebody perceives and experiences their life, and we know that we have the three levels of measurement. What is health-related quality of life? Well, health-related quality of life is one of several patient-reported outcome measures. According to the FDA definition published in 2006, a patient-reported outcome is any report coming from patients about a health condition and its treatment. Examples include satisfaction with treatment, patient reports about care, and health behaviors, such as adherence to treatment. Health-related quality of life measures functioning and well-being in three domains of health: physical, mental, and social. And surveys that use health-related quality of life measures usually target physical functioning, role functioning, social functioning, emotional well-being, such as depressive symptoms, anger, anxiety, pain, energy, and general health perceptions. Examples include SF-36 and PROMIS. SF-36, most of you are familiar with it. It's the 36-item short form health survey, which is a set of generic self-administered quality of life measures. PROMIS stands for the Patient-Reported Outcome Measurement Information System, and this is an NIH-funded development of psychometrically validated measures that can be applied to participants with a wide range of chronic diseases and also demographic characteristics. It has adult and pediatric measures, and the adult measures have actually more than 1,000 individual questions, 51 distinct item banks, and it's been translated in 20 languages so far. Another important aspect of health-related quality of life is that it is increasingly used in clinical practice. Typically, health-related quality of life measures are used for comparative performance evaluation, for quality assurance, and evaluation of health interventions. But when used in clinical practice, they have been found to facilitate patient-physician communication and also to contribute to a physician's holistic understanding of a patient's health experience. One of the studies I looked at consider the application of health and quality of life measures in clinical oncology practice. And the findings were quite interesting. So patients reported being very satisfied with the nature of their communications with the physicians. Physicians also reported that the quality of life summaries that they had been provided on top of somebody's clinical charts had a positive impact on communication, provided a very useful overall impression of their patient's functional health and symptom experience, and increased efficiency with which they elicit relevant information from their patients. And none of the doctors said that they found these measures to be disruptive in any way to the way in which they usually conducted their interactions with the patients. So, so very, very positive. So now that we know how I think subjective well-being and health-related quality of life are best defined, I'm going to introduce the research question and the methods. So the research question is, what are the commonalities or areas of overlap among subjective well-being and health-related quality of life measures? And to explain this question, I have to say that in the past decade, there has been a marked increase in research on quality of life and measurement of happiness. And this reflects a concern on the part of government agencies, predominantly in the U.S. and Western Europe, that they need to be able to measure the life satisfaction and quality of life of their citizens in a way that's more targeted and more informative. If we look at the measures that are traditionally used, for example, GDP, that is a measure of market performance and economic development. It doesn't tell us much about how people perceive their quality of life. So there's a lot of potential for subjective well-being to be applied in public policy and economic development, but there's also potential for subjective well-being in healthcare and in clinical practice. To do that, however, we need to understand exactly what subjective well-being adds that's meaningful, new, and different from what we already garner from health-related quality of life. So this explains my research question. To answer this research question, I first used a conceptual approach, and to conduct this conceptual approach, I did a literature review using the search terms up on the slide. I started with PubMed and Google Scholar and using each term individually, and that yielded more than 20,000 search, and this was just a 3-month project. So I had to figure out a way around it, so I used combinations of these terms, got it down to 699, and then after abstract review, removal of duplicates and articles that weren't relevant, I managed to narrow it down to 72 articles and 2 systematic reviews on subjective well-being and health-related quality of life. I also used an empirical or statistical approach, and for this, I relied on 2 data sets that had been collected through the PROMISE project, which I described previously. This approach set us apart from the studies that had been conducted earlier on because they used smaller samples and populations that were very specific, for example, drug users or elderly men. So this is an approach that includes the general population. The first sample, 21,133 individuals. The majority of those, about 19,000, have been recruited through YouGov polymetrics panel sample, and about 1,500 have been recruited at medical sites. And the second sample, 2,996 individuals. And in our analysis, we examined the associations of overall quality of life, so evaluative subjective well-being only, with health-related quality of life measures. The next slides will show some of the salient points from my conceptual research on health-related quality of life. And the study that stood out is that by Taillefer and colleagues in 2003. I'm probably butchering some of these names, so I apologize in advance. So they conducted a systematic review of 68 health-related quality of life models between 1965 and 2001. And what they noted was that some of the definitions and frameworks and conceptual models were remarkably unsophisticated. In fact, they wrote that fewer than half even explained their quality of life concepts and definitions clearly. And to give you an example from one paper they cite, somebody defined health-related quality of life as the degree to which a person enjoys the important possibilities in his or her life. So we can see that this obscures their intent. Do you want to focus on satisfaction? Do you want to focus on functioning? So very poor. The framework that I found particularly useful was the model proposed by Fong and Hayes in 2008. The definition of health-related quality of life here is the same as the one I described earlier. So a measure that looks at functioning and well-being in physical, mental, and social health. And here, in this diagram, health-related quality of life is depicted as part of the wider patient journey, if you will, and it is the ultimate outcome of care. The circles represent latent constructs, so multiple indicators define the constructs, and the boxes or rectangles represent observed indicators, so the construct is measured directly. So we have health-related quality of life in the bottom right hand. And in this model, it is influenced by patient health behaviors, which in turn are influenced by patient satisfaction with care. So we could argue that if a patient is satisfied with their care, they're more likely to adhere to their drug prescriptions or whatever their physicians recommend. In this model, health-related quality of life is also impacted by patient characteristics in the top left corner. Such characteristics include values, personal values, beliefs about health and health systems, and social support. At the center of the diagram, we have quality of care, and this too influences health-related quality of life. Quality of care is measured through technical quality, but also through patient reports about care. So this framework complements the definition that I provided earlier, and again, I hope it serves as a point of reference as we discussed the other conceptual research findings. The next set of slides will show the outcome of my research on subjective well-being, and it will show differences of opinions among scholars with regards to how to define subjective well-being. Some of these definitions are, some of these differences are more subtle, others are more pronounced. So we begin with Diener and Hsu in 1997. They published a paper in which they defined subjective well-being as a measure of life satisfaction, pleasant and unpleasant affect. They argue that these three aspects are independent of each other. So it is possible for somebody to have a high score on their life satisfaction, but a low score on their pleasant affect, or a low or high score on their unpleasant affect. On the other hand, Christakopoulou and colleagues in 2001 published a paper in which they defined subjective well-being as a multi-dimensional concept of satisfaction with the built environment, personal safety, community spirit, social interactions, and community characteristics. The examples that they provide for the built environment include cleanliness of streets and environment, green space, road conditions, local services in the area where a person lives. For community spirit, they refer to the ability to rely on one another to maintain good relationships and collaborations. And other community characteristics, they're talking about anything in a community that affects residents physically, psychologically, and socially. Haas, in 1999, has a more complicated approach to subjective well-being. She argues that subjective well-being is a subjective evaluation that encompasses all dimensions of life, such as physical, psychological, social, and spiritual. She also describes these dimensions as quality of life indicators. So in her view, subjective well-being is a sum of these quality of life indicators. And when we measure them, she argues that we get well-being, a measure of well-being, which is subjective. But then she goes on to say that when we measure them, we also get a measure of functional status, which is objective. But she doesn't go on to elaborate exactly what she means. So this is one of the more challenged definitions, if you will. In 2004, Helliwell and Putnam, and Putnam here is Robert Putnam of Bowling Alone fame, Describe subjective well-being as a person's individual evaluation in response to their objective conditions. And by objective conditions, they meant social conditions, such as marriage and family, ties to friends or neighbors, workplace ties, civic engagement both individually and collectively, trustworthiness and trust. And they argued that all these social conditions affect well-being both directly and indirectly through these conditions' impact on health. Also in 2004, Shaloh published a paper in which subjective well-being is described as a determinant of quality of life. And subjective well-being, in his view, is a personal appraisal of emotional well-being, interpersonal relations, material well-being, personal development, physical well-being, self-determination, social inclusion, and rights. And finally, on this list, I haven't singled out any studies for your attention because all of these studies, by and large, define quality of life and subjective well-being as equivalent. And I tend to agree with this view because if we understand quality of life as a composite score of psychological, physical, social, spiritual, and economic well-being, then subjective well-being, as I explained earlier, as a eudaimonic experience and evaluative measure, can touch on all these areas. So I quite agree with this view. So now that we have seen how the range of definitions in the literature, let's take a look at how this is operational, how subjective well-being is operationalized in surveys. So this first, we have an example of evaluative well-being. This is Diener's Satisfaction with Life Scale. And it's a series of five statements followed by response options that relate to the level of agreement or disagreement by the respondent. So in most ways, my life is close to ideal. The conditions of my life are excellent. I'm satisfied with my life. So far, I have gotten the important things I want in my life. If I could live my life again, I would change almost nothing. When we look at these examples of evaluative well-being, some scholars argue that the respondents will take a longer-term outlook on their life. However, this past summer, Ari Kaptein and colleagues published a very interesting paper in which they referenced four studies that cautioned that when some respondents answer to these questions, they might be influenced by minor events or their moods at the time of response. And the extent of the influence of these contextual effects is still a matter of debate. Next, I have another example of evaluative well-being. It's just a single item. It's seductively simple. How satisfied are you with your life in general? And again, so the response options are very satisfied, somewhat dissatisfied, very dissatisfied. So this question prompts the respondent to issue a global judgment on their quality of life, but they wouldn't issue this judgment unless they were asked to. And again, we can see why some scholars fear that it is their mood and their affect at the time that they're asking the question that could impact how they answer this question. I also have an example of eudaimonic well-being. This is used by the Office of National Statistics in the United Kingdom. So overall, to what extent do you feel that the things you do in your life are worthwhile? And the response options on a scale from 0, not at all, to 10, completely. In the literature, I noticed that some people found that this and other indicators of eudaimonic well-being correlate highly with questions about evaluative well-being. And in particular, they point to the question that was up on the previous slide. Let's move on to an example of experienced well-being. This one uses the DRM, stands for the Day Reconstruction Method. And this is a way to probe participants about events and feelings of the previous day. So it's not named after somebody whose last name was Day. Right, so here we have the first set of questions, three questions. They require specific answers. So what time of the week was yesterday? So if I were to ask Marissa, I hope she doesn't say Sunday. What time did you wake up yesterday? What time did you go to sleep at the end of the day yesterday? The other two questions offer response options. So yesterday, did you feel any pain? None, a little, some, quite a bit, a lot. The last question, did you feel well rested yesterday morning? That is, you slept well the night before, yes or no? And if we look at the sort of answers that these questions are trying to elicit, we see that experienced well-being is informed by individuals' affect, sensations, and emotions at a specific point in time when they answer these questions. I have another example of experienced well-being for you. This is just a sample of questions from the Health Well-Being 12 questionnaire. Yesterday, did you feel happy, enthusiastic, content, angry, frustrated? And the response options are not at all, a little, somewhat, quite a bit, very. The other questions ask about feeling tired, sad, stressed, lonely, worried, bored, or pain. In the next set of slides, I will look at the results from the conceptual research, but about the overlap between subjective well-being and health-related quality of life. And I will begin with Kiefer. Again, if you remember, they conducted a systematic review of 68 health-related quality of life models. And they found that approximately 30% assumed that health-related quality of life and subjective well-being were identical, but the majority assumed that subjective well-being was a component of health-related quality of life. If we look at the definitions provided by Hayes, Hahn, and Marshall in 2002, so they defined health-related quality of life in terms of functioning and well-being. And in their view, well-being includes happiness, sadness, depression, and anxiety. So we see that they're touching on the same sort of emotions and problems that some of the subjective well-being questions address. Another interesting study came from Park, published earlier this summer, and she's looking at how meaning is reflected in health-related quality of life. If we look at how she defines meaning, yet again, we see that she seems to hint at the three types of well-being measurements that we've examined: experienced, eudaimonic, and evaluative. So in her view, meaning includes cognitive elements, for example, the coherence or comprehension of the world. It includes motivational aspects, overarching goals or mission, and it includes emotional and evaluative elements, the sense that one's life matters and that it is significant to others. And then she proceeds to link meaning to health-related quality of life through three influencing pathways. First, health behaviors. She argues that people with stronger sense of meaning and purpose in life want to live longer, and therefore they will embrace healthier behaviors. The second pathway is psychological processes. Higher levels of meaningfulness relate to favorable physiological processes, such as better heart rate. And finally, coping function. She believes that religiousness and spirituality may improve physical and mental health. Another interesting study came from Australia. From Miller and colleagues, this is a more recent study. On a group of drug users, they assessed predictors of subjective well-being. What's interesting about their study, though, and it stands out in a negative way, is that they defined health-related quality of life as an objective measure. They defined it as the evaluation of life that can be confirmed by others. They measured it through SF8. And subjective well-being, in their view, is a subjective measure, and it refers to an individual's evaluation of their life satisfaction and happiness, and they measure that through the personal well-being index. So their predictors of subjective well-being were full-time employment, part-time employment, severity of dependence scale, because it was a sample of drug users, the mental health summary score from the SF8, and physical health. And they found out that it was only the mental health component and part-time employment that were the only predictors of subjective well-being. Back to Europe, in 2014, Berger and colleagues looked at a sample of people living with HIV in the Netherlands, and they found that subjective well-being was strongly associated with the mental health summary score from SF-12. The correlation was 0.41, and environmental well-being, for example, general satisfaction with and safety of one's surroundings, correlation was 0.51. And finally, Spiro and Bossi had an interesting study in 2000. They looked at two large samples of relatively healthy older men. Theirs was comprehensive because they measured all types of subjective well-being, so evaluative, experienced, and eudaimonic. And on their samples, they administered a 6-item measure of overall quality of life, survey of life satisfaction index, 4 well-being scales, SF-36, and a 38-item mental health inventory. And they found that health-related quality of life and subjective well-being overlap marginally. If they were asked to choose between the two measures, they said that they wouldn't choose, that the two measures complement each other. So subjective well-being is less related to physical and more related to psychological aspects of health-related quality of life. And health-related quality of life is important for its physical component, but also its measurement of function. So this concludes my review of the conceptual research. Next, I will present the findings from the empirical or statistical analysis. So just to remind you, we used two samples from the PROMISE data sets, and these are their characteristics. I'll be referring to them as wave one and wave two. And as we see here, in terms of characteristics, wave one and wave two seem to be quite similar in terms of age and gender. In terms of race and ethnicity, wave two seems to be more diverse. In terms of education, wave two, again, seems to have people with more education. If you look at the global quality of life, you see that in wave one, more than 50% of respondents said that they had excellent or very good global quality of life, whereas in wave two, less than 50% said that. In terms of physical health, and both wave one and wave two, less than half of respondents reported excellent or very good physical health. Moving on to mental health. Wave one, nearly two-thirds of people said they had excellent or very good mental health, whereas in wave two, less than half said they had excellent or very good mental health. In terms of general health, in both ways, less than half of people reported that they had excellent or very good general health. Emotional problems, in wave one, more than half said that they were not bothered by emotional problems, whereas in wave two, less than half reported excellent or very good emotional health. And finally, the Health Utility Index Mark III, which was only applied to wave two. This is a composite score that measures attributes such as vision, hearing, speech, ambulation, dexterity, emotion, cognition, and pain. And we see here that the average score is 0.54. This index is measured on a scale from 0 to 1, where 0 means to somebody that it's as bad as being dead, and 1 is perfect health. In the range, we also notice a negative value. The Health Utility Index Mark III allows negative values, and these reflect an individual's perception that a health state is considered worse than being dead. So the range is negative 0.36, which is the lowest possible range according to the formula, and 1, which is perfect health. So next, I'll show you a couple of tables with the output from the regressions.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Sure.
What's the difference between wave 1 and wave 2?
These are two separate samples. Yes, so wave one was collected before wave two. I believe so. It's the first one that was collected.
Yeah, that's the one that most people would know as wave one. Now, wave two was supposed to be similar, the similar idea. You know, they were both panel companies, but it turns out, you know, as the results you've shown you, that people looked a lot sicker than you would expect in the general population. And so it turned out that it wasn't nearly as useful for the same purposes that they used in wave one.
So next I'll show you the output from the wave one regressions and correlations. So on the right-hand side column, we have the results of our correlations. I should point out that all of them are statistically significant, and they range from 0.29 for self-care to 0.69 for general health. If you look at the regression coefficients, 9 of the 14 items that we entered as independent variables are uniquely statistically associated with overall quality of life, and they account for 69% of the variation in overall quality of life. The largest associations were satisfaction with social activities, physical health, general health, and mental health. Moving on to wave two. Again, the correlations are on the right-hand side of the table. Again, all of them were statistically significant, and they ranged from 0.36 for pain to 0.82 for physical health. And looking at the regression coefficients, we note that 7 of the 10 that we entered are significantly uniquely associated with overall quality of life, and they account for 75% of the variation in overall quality of life. The largest associations were physical health, general health, and mental health. I've also prepared a graph to sort of summarize the results of the regressions. So we have healthy quality of life, physical, mental, and social domains, and the gray rectangles show the domains that predicted subjective well-being. And so what we see here is that this is by and large consistent with previous research. So there's ample evidence in the literature that satisfaction with social activities is associated with overall quality of life. The predictive association between mental health and overall quality of life is also aligns with previous findings. But the physical health, the strong predictive association between physical health and overall quality of life stands out. There are only a handful of studies that found associations, but they seem to be weak. So this is a finding that's different in our study. And to summarize what we've done so far, so we looked at the conceptual overlap between subjective well-being and health-related quality of life, and we have found evidence of that in the literature. We've looked at the empirical or statistical overlap, and we have found, again, evidence that there is such an overlap, and it is consistent with previous research. And we found a strong predictive relationship between physical health and overall quality of life. However, there is a caveat, which is explained by our shortcomings. So we only examined evaluative well-being. We didn't look at experienced well-being or eudaimonic well-being. And this is a weakness insofar as a very interesting document from the National Academy of Sciences mentions that experienced well-being might be better suited for health research. And some examples of such use, when interventions have outcomes that are other than increased life expectancy. For example, when you work with elderly people or people with dementia, and you're more interested in improving their quality of life rather than the length of their life. Another instance, when people, you know, doctors, physicians define successful treatment in a way that's not confined to just signs and symptoms, but goes well beyond that to domains such as functioning and social integration. And the third instance of its usefulness in health is when parties other than patients are affected by treatment and symptoms, for example, carers, family, and friends. So, given the shortcomings and everything we found out so far, what is the way forward?
Well, I think there should the research should continue to look at the overlap between these two measures in specific patient populations, for example, people with kidney disease or spinal cord injury. And there should be more research about the interplay between evaluative well-being and experienced well-being. And I see a lot of use for this in my area of interest, which is patients with spinal cord injury. And I feel that if, for example, we were to add experienced well-being measures to health-related quality of life measurements, we would be able to see how different people adapt differently to the changing situations in their life. So people with spinal cord injury usually become spinal cord injured after a traumatic accident. It's very sudden, and changes in their life are radical. They need to undergo extensive rehabilitation. They need to maybe use catheters. They need to use wheelchairs. And so measuring their experienced well-being at different points in time could be helpful in informing rehabilitation and informing wheelchair prescription and informing how the treatment experience goes. And this, in turn, could be fed into service provision. So knowing how they experience their new wheelchair could then feed back to their care team and rehabilitation experts and make adjustments accordingly. So, and I plan to do my part because, as Dr. Hayes mentioned, my dissertation proposal focuses on subjective well-being, health-related quality of life, and spinal cord injury patients. So this concludes my presentation. I hope that you've enjoyed it, and it hasn't been too much of a horror show. I hope it's been a treat more than a treat. And that's it, and I'm happy to take your questions.
I guess if you go back a little bit, you don't have to be up there, but I think this association you report between physical health and overall quality of life, as you kind of noted, is a little bit surprising.
Yeah.
But one of the things you need to look into further, since this was limited by, one summer, is the nature of the, and I don't think you really had enough time to explain to people exactly what's in that model, but you primarily are relying on single questions. And the single question about physical health, which people could see, has excellent rapport as a response option, and so does overall quality of life. So partly this correlation may be a little higher than you'd otherwise expect, just due to common method variance. And when you're asking people single questions with similar response formats, there might be a little bit of just sort of a method variance in common. Because it surprised me, actually, that physical health is that strong,
yes,
even in a zero order correlation.
Yeah.
I can make a few comments, Jonathan. A lot of questions is better, but one thing you may not know about is that there are two organizations that are doing this kind of work, and they actually, what you're talking about could be helpful for kind of linking them together. So they both have very similar names. They started about the same time in 1994. One of them is the International Society of Quality of Life Research, and their annual meeting is this week. I'm actually leading for it tomorrow. And the other one is the International Society for Quality of Life Studies, and their meeting was last week, and I went to that one for the first time. So International Society for Quality of Life Research, they do the health-related quality of life stuff that you're talking about. So that's kind of physical, mental, social, functioning, well-being. The other organization, even though they have quality of life in their titles, the other organization focuses on subjective well-being, and they focus on like the single item kind of measures of satisfaction, happiness. But what they also focus on is GNP, like you mentioned that, and income. And they seem to be very interested in looking across countries and looking at trends over time and saying, okay, if you improve GNP, which they often use as a main measure of some underlying well-being, does that really translate to better ratings of happiness or life satisfaction? That seems to be, you know, the high priority of that organization. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of overlap, yet, you know, they each have sort of different niches, and mm-hmm. they're different people that go to these two meetings. So there's essentially, you know, very little, if no overlap in the people. You just mm-hmm. kind of have a lot of economists in the latter organization, the one that focuses on, of course, on GNP and so forth. And not as many economists. It's more like health services researchers and others.
Right. Yeah, no, I found the, when I read about the GDP measurement, I find it interesting because every week I watch this show from the UK called Question Time, and it's an opportunity for people from around the country to ask questions of politicians. And every time the government issues reports saying the GDP has increased by 0.6%, invariably, there's a person in the audience who asks, the government reported today an increase, why don't I feel it in my life? And nobody on the panel, they get some very smart people on their panels, and nobody points out, well, because it doesn't measure how you feel in your life, it just measures market changes and economic changes. And I feel that the UK has been very proactive in, as you know, in using subjective well-being, and also for their National Health Service, they're using a lot of health-related quality of life measurements to feed back into the system.
Yeah, well, there were different speakers at this last meeting, and one of them is Easterlin, and he had like kind of this paradox that he's been known for forever, where if you look over time, really, when you improve GNP, it doesn't seem to translate into happiness. Like happiness kind of goes, as you might expect, like if there's a real, when 2009 that happiness mm-hmm. went down in many countries, but then it kind of comes back up and the overall trend is flat, whereas income tends to be going up. So there's his, and he was arguing, well, just what you said, the, you know, GNP, you really shouldn't be relying on that, although that's still being done on. Whereas someone else, Carol Graham, who maybe is in your literature that I can't remember, she was saying, well, we still should use GNP as a primary and just kind of supplement it a little with subjective well-being to see and
right.
make sure that it's sort of translating into
right.
that. So they're still debating that.
Oh, how, yeah,
where
absolutely.
This is, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the range of definitions and conceptualizations shows that people come from so many different angles on this, and it's just a matter of clearly stating what you mean by this and then build your paper on that.
Is anyone doing any research in relation to political affiliation? Just knows what he's thinking about the assets of this.
No, I haven't looked for it. Oh, you mean if Republicans are happier than Democrats? Or
yes.
Yeah, I bet the International Society of Quality of Life Studies, which has applied research in quality of life, I bet anywhere it's there. I mean, I was hearing little tidbits like, women tend to be a little happier than men. Carol Graham said that. I'd have to look it up, you know, to really verify is there really consistent evidence. But I didn't hear anything about politics at that meeting, but I bet there is. Someone can look in the literature and see, you know, whether Republicans or Democrats or independents or whatever. There's probably someone, you know, kind of, I don't know if there's consistent results or anything.
The thing that struck me is that there seems to be a little bit of a sea change in politics at the moment. In the UK, we just elected a Social Democrat as leader of the left centre party, and here there's a lot of interest in Bernie Sanders. And it seems to me that there's an immense liberation amongst people's feelings. The difference between people feeling that they're not being heard and they are being heard can result. People are saying this guy is unelectable, and there seems to be a definite mood that. In a sense, that's not the first objective to get into power. The first objective is to be heard and to feel that you're part of a community
yeah.
of people who have the same opinion and that you're being listened to and you have a sense of community spirit, which I think is quite an interesting phenomenon, which is why I mentioned it, because it just occurred to me having been through this mm-hmm. presentation.
There might be pizza left if we want.
Thank you.